Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 7, Side 1. The snow, he could see through the compound roof, was coming down even heavier. Who cared? He put on a breathe mask with a fresh pair of cartridges, picked up the beautifully wrapped, and very difficult to unwrap, ultimate bomb, picked up his travel kit, and left his office for the last time. All was ready outside. 500 Brigantes, bows protected from the weather, looking a bit huddled and cold even in their buffalo coats, had been marched up and now stood in the formation he had carefully pointed out. A total ring with its back to the atmosphere cable, a nearly solid wall of Brigantes. Captain Arf Moifi seemed to be the officer in charge of them all.
Now you and your men all understand that you are only to use bows and poisoned arrows and knives or bayonets. There must be no firing of powder or blast weapons.
We's got all dat, called General Smith.
Ah, good.
General Smith and an honor guard of 6 Brigantes, all of them in air masks, were on the platform, armed with bows, which they were protecting from the snow. Turl looked around. It was a bit hard to see through these snowflakes and gusts of wind. He had heard a chattering from somewhere. What was that? By the crap nebula, the whole Brigante tribe was gathered down by the morgue to see General Smith off.
Amazing.
The women were all bundled up against the snow, and off-duty mercenaries were in among them. What a filthy mob. Good thing he was wearing a mask, for he knew they smelled awful. And there was Brown Limper Staffer and Lars Thorensen. They had come up on the plateau with a ground car and were standing there. The very people he wanted to see. Turl walked over to them. Instead of saying goodbye, or even, nice to have known you, Brown Limper Staffer said,
I don't see Tyler.
Turl stopped before him. Brown Limper was all bundled up in some kind of expensive fur. Snow was falling upon his hair and collar. His eyes looked feverishly overbright.
Oh, he'll be here, said Turl. He'll be here.
Turl looked down at Brown Limper's feet. There was a case there, a fat case about 3 feet long.
Aha!
Turl stooped, and before Brown Limper or Lars could stop him, picked up the case and, with a cuff of his paw, broke the locks. A Thompson submachine gun. So he was right to distrust this animal. One shot from this thing during a firing could blow up the platform. Turl took the weapon by the barrel, and with his paws bent it in a half circle. He threw it aside.
That was not nice, said Turl. You could have blown up the whole place.
Brown Limper didn't seem upset. His eyes still looked furtive. Turl took Lars's belt gun, took the cartridge canister out of it, and threw it 50 feet away.
No firing,
said Turl, waggling a cautionary claw in front of their faces. Did Brown Limper have something else? Turl wondered. He looked quite unhinged, but not about the guns.
Here, said Turl, in a cajoling tone of voice. Here is a nice present to make it up to you.
He handed Brown Limper the thoroughly wrapped ultimate bomb. It weighed about 80 pounds, and as Brown Limper took it, he almost dropped it. Turl, in some apprehension, caught it before it could fall. Turl managed to smile as he restored it to Brown Limper.
It's a nice gift, said Turl. Open it when I'm gone, and you'll find the answer to your most golden dreams. Something to remember me by.
No danger in giving it to them. It would take them an hour to get the wrapper off. Then one lift of the lid and bang! No planet. Turl patted Brown Limper on the head. He glanced at his watch. Still plenty of time. He walked over toward the platform. Captain Arf Moifi called his men to attention. Turl marched on by. With a bold and martial step, Turl walked to the console. He reached down and closed the bus bar on the atmosphere armor cable. Snow flew up all along its length. Good. He was now safe. A solid wall enclosed the console and platform, and beyond that, a solid wall of armed bodies. He glanced at his watch. He had plenty of time. He walked over to the baggage and kicked his own kit into the pile. The Brigantes had brought quite a mound of air bottles for themselves. General Smith, militarily dressed in a buffalo coat, his diamond in his cap, his cross belts jammed with poison arrows, gave him a chest-pound salute. But he asked, "You gonna change de money for cure?" He pointed to a huge mound of money, brown limper notes. "Absolutely," Turl reassured him. "Credits go where credit is due. Besides, you have me hostage, don't you?" Smith was reassured. And speaking of hostages, Turl leaned over the long bundle and opened the top of it. Black, glaring eyes pierced him. He beckoned to the Brigante so assigned, and the man pushed an air mask on the face and shoved the bottle onto the chest. He buckled the bottle on. He had almost gotten bit. Turl looked at his watch. The time was coming up. He walked over to the console. He moved the toggle switch in the upper left-hand corner to the up position. He threw on the activating bus bar. The console's top buttons glowed. Turl sat there counting down the seconds. Then he punched in the long-since-memorized coordinates. He checked his watch for the exact instant. He punched the firing button. He reached down and activated the 10-minute time bomb. The wires began to build up a hum. Out of the tail of his eye, he saw a man rise up beyond the brown limper car. Somebody jumping up. Somebody in a radiation suit. Turl looked hard and suddenly realized it looked like and must be the animal. Huh, brown limper had gotten his Tyler after all. He walked over to the center of the platform. The hum was building up. What joy to think of being safe on Cyclo in just under 3 minutes. 2. Brown Limper's staffer had seethed when Turl discovered the submachine gun, but the sight of the barrel being bent almost double had caused him to hold his peace. This huge monster was strong. So he stood there and accepted the gift. Actually, it must be gold, it was so heavy. He had no qualms about accepting gold, even if it looked like a bribe. He had earned it. But his mind was only slightly on all that. He was still looking avidly for Tyler. But he decided he would wait until Turl was safely at that console. He saw Captunk Arf Moifi salute. Saw the Brigantes draw up and begin to take poisoned arrows from the crossbelts. Saw the performance on the platform. Turl had somebody else there in the bundle. Tyler? No, it couldn't be Tyler, or Turl would have called out. Maybe it was Tyler. Maybe Turl was double-crossing him. No, it couldn't be Tyler. Who was it? But yes, it might be Tyler. They put an air mask on whoever it was. They meant to take somebody to Cyclo. No, it couldn't be Tyler. But maybe it was. When the snow had jumped up from the ground, Brown Limper had been slightly startled. But nothing had happened except that Turl went over to that bundle. Ah, finally, Turl was going back to the console. Brown Limper had been told the wires would begin to hum. He would wait for that. It was hard to see in this snow. The white glare of it and the swirls and the wind gusts kept blanking out things. But he could listen. He thought he heard the hum start. He couldn't be sure. The wind was making sounds, and that Brigante mob was yelling goodbyes to General Smith. Brown Limper thought he had better wait until Turl walked back to the platform center before he moved. In the back of the car was another submachine gun. Brown Limper had thought of everything. The moment Turl reached the middle of the platform, Brown Limper would dive into the back of the car, get the Thompson submachine gun, load it, and race to that platform edge and spray the whole place. It must be Tyler in that bundle. Brown Limper stood there, holding the gift, waiting for Tyrrell to walk away from the console. The yells of the Briganti tribe and the whirr of the wind made it impossible to tell whether the hum had started. He would have to be sure. He had better wait for the last moment. Then Tyrrell couldn't rush off the platform to stop him. He didn't hear the thud of running feet behind him. Suddenly, two hands reached out and grabbed at the gift. A radiation-masked face and an air mask under the radiation mask. Then he saw the blonde beard through all that leaded glass. Tyler was right on top of him.
Run! Yelled the face.
The hands whipped the gift away from Brown Limper.
Run for your life!
Came from the half-hidden face. Then the man turned and, carrying the package, sprinted toward the hangar side of the compound. The figure was growing thinner in the snow, hard to see.
Shoot him!
Screamed Brown Limper to Lars. He whirled. Lars was running away. He was already 100 feet away and half hidden in snow flurries. He was running as hard as he could toward Denver. But then something registered with Brown Limper. That voice. He knew Tyler's voice. Even through masks and shields, he did not think it was Tyler's voice. It had sounded Swedish? But Tyler must be around. Around someplace. Brown Limper tore his way to the door of the car to get the other gun. The door on that side was locked. With a whimper of despair, Brown Limper raced around the car. He had to get to that other gun. And even as he went, above the snow, above the yells, he heard Tyler's voice from the platform. Unmistakable. He must hurry. 3. Dwight rose cautiously just behind the lip of the ravine. He was dressed in a radiation camouflage suit with an air mask behind its lead glass faceplate. As Tyrrell first entered the platform area, Dwight held the mind radio close to his shield glass and said, "First alert." Dwight had been chosen as officer of the outside raiders because he could be depended upon to follow orders exactly, without deviation, and as one of the load mine crew chiefs, he could handle men. They had lain since shortly after midnight in the lead coffins buried at spaced intervals around the platform's perimeter. The coffins had been positioned long since by care and cadets in the night while they laid the armor cable. They had been covered with dirt and now were also covered by a layer of snow. It had been no trick to slip in last night. The Briganti guards, drunk on drugged whiskey as they had been every night for 2 months, had detected nothing. Dwight had a streak of superstition. It all had gone almost too smoothly. Johnny was inside that atmosphere cable area, buried in a coffin just at the edge of the firing platform. Fire from outside would not hit him. They had tested that. But the thought of Johnny in there alone with those savage beasts made Dwight numb. He had tried to get Johnny to let somebody else do it, but Johnny had said no, he would not put a man to that risk. Somebody had to be in there to shut off the armor cable, use a remote control to complete the action of the crane, and lower an armored dome down over the console to protect it. The crane could not get the dome cover through the atmosphere armor unless it was shut off. Something about a switch position that had to be determined at the firing. A switch that might automatically shift once the humming stopped. And somebody had to cut the cables away from the console. Dwight had wanted to send 3 men in. Johnny had said that many wouldn't fit in the dome with the console. Tyrrell had now walked to the console. Dwight said, "Second alert," into the mine radio. The third would come when Tyrrell pushed the firing button. Action would be called when he was at the platform center and the wires had begun to hum. Dwight and his team had only 1.5 minutes to do their entire job. They had drilled and drilled in Africa, but one never knew. The snow flurries made the visibility sporadic. But he could see what he had to see. My God, that was an awful lot of Brigantes. They were a solid line all around the perimeter of the platform, backs right up against the atmosphere ionization cable. They looked lumpy in buffalo coats. They were protecting their bowstrings, but their crossbelts bristled with poisoned arrows. Dr. Allen had briefed them on those arrows. The poison was slow, but deadly. It caused the nervous system to speed up faster and faster until it killed. He had developed an antidotal serum for it. He had given them all a small shot of it, but he said any wound would need speedy treatment all the same. They each carried a small ampoule of the serum. Dwight hoped it worked. Then he saw that there would be 7 Brigantes on the platform. Was that the one they called General Smith and a squad? They had not counted on that. What a fool Smith must be to permit himself to be fired to Cyclo. But Johnny, he wouldn't have added that into the plans. Was it too late for Dwight to do something? His orders were very positive, to do nothing but his job. They had somebody else on the platform, bound. Who was that? My God, Johnny's plan wouldn't work. He would be in there all but defenseless. Dwight gritted his teeth. His orders were to do his job only. He would. But he had a feeling of despair for Johnny. The Brigante tribe was noisy and cheering over there by the morgue. They were no problem. Dwight turned his attention back to Turl. The Cyclo pushed the firing button.
Third alert, said Dwight into the mine radio.
The weapons they would use would not interrupt the firing. They had tested them. They also had nuclear weapons in case Cyclos came in on the platform afterward from Cyclo. Turl walked over to the center of the platform. He halted. The humming had begun, heard above the shouting and wind. Dwight heard Johnny's voice in that enclosure. That was not on schedule. Dwight would do his job.
Action!
Barked Dwight into the mine radio. 30 Scots threw off their coffin lids. 25 hit their igniters. 1 made ready to rush for the crane. 4 were up to form a reserve. Flash! In a ragged outer ring, pointing in at the massed Brigantes, 25 Russian flamethrowers spewed out their deadly orange spray. Like 25 hoses, the roaring inferno slashed into the Brigantes.
For Allison! Came a Scot battle cry. For Bitty! Scotland forever!
Dwight hit the button of a planted loudspeaker. It was a recording of charging, trumpeting elephants, the sound that would bring terror to the Brigantes. The mercenaries surged forward, trying to get their bows into action. Scything flames shriveled the bowstrings. The Brigantes were drawing bayonets to charge. The tribe by the morgue screamed, adding to the din. They turned and ran with all their might out into the plain, trampling one another as they sought to get away. A Scot had a flame out. A group of Brigantes were charging him with bayonets.
Cover Andrew! Barked Dwight.
The Scots on either side of the dead flamethrower widened their arcs. Andrew had a claymore out. He cut down the Brigante officer, and then he himself went down. 2 of the reserves hacked their way into the mess with Lochaber axes and slaughtered the Brigantes, stabbing at Andrew. Dwight glanced at his watch. 58 seconds to go. Flamethrowers were sending boiling flame into Brigantes. Their buffalo coats and monkey-skin suits were balls of fire. Another attempted charge by them. Dwight tried to see through the flame and snow. The crane. It should be moving now. Yes, the operator had gotten to it. One of the reserves was protecting him with a flamethrower. They had buried the dome cover for the console in the ground with the cable already attached. It was evidently frozen in. It was made of the armor from a discarded tank. The bottom of it was equipped with plane skids, which would anneal to the metal on which the console sat and seal it. Dwight could see the top of the crane dipping. The operator was rocking it to break the dome loose from the ground. There it came. It rose with a rush. It swung. The operator steadied it. Brigantes were rushing the crane. The Scot there blasted at them with a roaring flamethrower. The operator was coolly swinging the dome over to position. It could not go further than the atmosphere armor screen. Dwight could see the operator throw the controls over to remote. Johnny had the remote there in the cage, and would have to do the rest of it if and when he shut off the current to the armor cable. Dwight tried to see what was happening on the platform. Snow flurries, smoke, and roaring arcs of savage orange flame barred his view. He was sure Johnny needed help. He gritted his teeth and did his job. Here and there along the perimeter, the flamethrowers were now off. Changing bottles? No. The Brigantes within their reach were burning piles. Black, greasy smoke was rising up through the white snow. Dwight glanced at his watch. They had time. His own cue to dive back into cover was when Johnny turned off the cable and the dome began to lower. Then he was under orders to get back in protective cover in the coffin. Scots were mopping up with flamethrowers. Two of the reserves were speedily putting Andrew in his coffin. They were shoving wound pads hastily under the radiation suit. A Brigante rose out of a pile of corpses. He had a bayonet. He charged. A thrown dirk hit him. A flamethrower erupted, and he went forward as a spinning ball of fire. The crane operator was out of his crane and running back to his coffin foxhole.
10 seconds to withdraw, said Dwight into the mine radio.
It was suddenly quiet except for flame crackles and the wind. Nothing was moving in the Brigante ranks but smoke and small tongues of fire. Allison and Bitty had been avenged. The fleeing remains of the tribe were way out on the plain, still running. The smoke was very thick. Dwight could not see what was happening on the platform. Numbers were coming back to him from his mine radio. A number was a signal that a man was back in his lead coffin in a foxhole and had fastened the lid down from within. Dwight was checking them off. All reported except Andrew, and he knew he had been put inside his coffin. Dwight hoped it wasn't his coffin for real. Dwight couldn't see the platform for the smoke. He watched the crane. Wires were still humming. They must all be under cover before the recoil, Johnny had said. Dwight looked at his watch. The armor curtain had not gone off. The top of the crane had not begun to move. He was in an agony of indecision. But he could not get inside that cage with the atmosphere armor curtain still on. He wanted to disobey orders. He knew Johnny was in trouble, for the curtain had not gone off on time. But he had been chosen because he would obey orders. Time was up. The humming had almost ended. Dwight crawled back to his coffin foxhole, scrambled in, and fastened down the lid from within. 4. When he heard "Alert 3" from the mine radio in his belt, Johnny had slid out of the coffin buried close by the platform and inside the atmosphere armor curtain. He was dressed in a camouflage radiation suit and wore an air mask under its face shield. His pouch was hanging from a wide belt. He was armed with 3 kill clubs, a dirk, and a flamethrower. He had a couple of other things for contingencies. He had not expected the Brigantes to be inside on the platform. 6 guards and General Smith. He hadn't thought even a Brigante would be crazy enough to let himself be fired to Cyclo. Money. They had bundles of money on the platform. They were all looking at Turl. Turl was turning away from pushing the firing button. The Brigantes had not noticed Johnny 30 feet away and slightly behind them. Well, it would not matter. Johnny started to ignite the flamethrower. And then he saw a movement. They had something in a long bundle. The end of it was open. They had somebody there. A hostage they were taking to Cyclo? Gray hair. The scrap of a cloak. Sir Robert. Johnny had to abandon any thought of using the flamethrower. It would kill Sir Robert as well. Turl was walking easily and confidently back from the console to the platform center. The wires were humming. He halted, thunderstruck. Just a moment ago, he had seen what he had thought was the animal outside, way over by the car. And here he was, inside the armor curtain. Was the curtain off? No, he could see it shimmer through the snow. How had the animal gotten through it? Just as Turl was about to charge, he saw the animal drop a long rod weapon he carried. The animal's hand darted toward a pouch at his belt. Johnny withdrew the contracts Turl had signed. He skimmed them to the platform center, the red seals glaring in the falling snow. Unmistakably, the contracts Turl had signed. Johnny shouted as loud as he could to be heard through masks and faceplates, "Don't forget to record these on Cyclo." Turl was horror-struck. The last thing he wanted to appear on Cyclo's platform were those phony contracts. Turl started to dive toward them and pick them up. He collided with Snith just as the general sought to give orders to his bowmen. Reaching down, Johnny picked up a beryllium ultimate bomb. He had intended to just throw it on the platform. It was wrapped with a cord. The golden glow of its metal, its size, and its hexagonal shape made it totally recognizable. The cord was not a fuse. The fuse was inside it, set for 8 minutes by a timing device on the top. It had an access plate in the bottom that was purposely jammed. Johnny touched the igniter he still held to the carrying cord end. 2 poisoned arrows whizzed by him. "Grenade!" shouted Johnny. He pitched the 80-pound weight straight at Turl. It struck the Cyclo a glancing blow and bounced down under his feet. 1 glimpse of a lit grenade, their own favorite weapon, caused the Brigantes to run. At that moment, trumpeting elephants sounded outside. The Brigantes hit the atmosphere armor curtain and were thrown back from it. Turl took 1 look at the bomb, and any thought he had about papers fled as his horror turned into terror. It was the bomb. But it had a time fuse. How had the animal gotten it away from Brown Limper, unwrapped it, and changed the fuse all in no time at all? But Turl knew what he had to do. He had to get rid of it fast. He was about to pitch it off the platform when the Brigantes came thudding back in recoil off the curtain. He knew that if he threw it, the bomb would just bounce back. The wires were humming. Turl knew he had to get that access plate off and remove the core and do it fast. He could even see the time fuse closing. He crouched down and began to claw at the access plate in the bottom. It was stuck. He fought with it. Johnny sprinted past Turl. He had to get Sir Robert and get him over to the console. A Brigante was up on 1 knee. A poisoned arrow slapped past Johnny's head. Johnny dragged Sir Robert clear of the long case. His hands and feet were tied. Sir Robert was shouting something. Something like, "Leave me and save yourself!" All chaos had broken out beyond the curtain. There were Scott battle cries and the roar of stampeding elephants. Flames splashed against the other side of the atmosphere armor. The falling snow, even inside the platform, was converting to rain. Heat. Turl was clawing at the access plate. He had no annealing knife to cut the metal. He was trying to scrape a circle and cut it with his claws. He was bellowing in frustration and adding to the uproar. 2 Brigantes charged Johnny. He let go of Sir Robert, snatched a kill club from his belt, and struck twice. They went down. He was able to drag Sir Robert a bit further. It was a long way to that console. Another Brigante was up. Johnny threw the kill club. It hit the mercenary's forehead, and his head went back at an incredible angle. Snith was up, shouting and pointing at Johnny. The din was deafening outside this cage. A Brigante tackled Johnny in the legs. Johnny got another kill club and smashed his brains out. He got Sir Robert a little further. The Scot was heavy. Snith was trying to get the last 2 of his guards to fire. Their bowstrings were too wet. They snatched out bayonets and charged. Johnny threw a kill club, and 1 Brigante was catapulted backward. The other came on. Johnny took his last kill club from his belt. He parried the bayonet and struck the Brigante alongside the head. The kill club flew out of his hand. He got Sir Robert a bit closer to the console. He was trying to pick Sir Robert up and carry him. For a moment, Johnny's back was turned. General Smith snatched a poison arrow out of his crossbelt and rushed. The heavy impact of the body hit Johnny's pouch. General Smith raised the poisoned arrow and drove it into Johnny's upper left arm, drove it in through the radiation suit and deep into the flesh. Johnny went down. He rolled, pulling a dirk. He came up and drove the knife into Smith's heart. The pain of the wound was savage. Johnny grasped the arrow shaft and pulled it straight out. But he knew the damage was done. The ferocious fire in the wound was almost more than he could bear. He gritted his teeth and rallied his strength. They had said it was a slow poison. He still might have time to save Sir Robert and the consul. He grabbed the hilt of the knife and tried to yank it out of Smith's heart. It was stuck. He looked at Turl. The cyclo, still raving, was clawing at the access plate. Tearing his claw points, he was actually cutting into the hard metal to make a circle and remove the core. It was quieter outside. Dwight's voice came out of the mine radio at his belt.
10 seconds to withdraw.
Johnny knew he was late. The wires were still humming. Johnny made himself concentrate. He still had a job to do. He could feel his heart revving up. He got a hand under Sir Robert's armpit and dragged him through the slush. He got to the console. He knew it had a bomb in it he would have to disarm fast. But he tucked Sir Robert in close to the console so the dome coming down would not amputate his arms or legs. He glanced at the console. The switch was in the up position. It would have to be in the down position when next this was fired. He wished he had time to tell somebody. He fumbled for his remote control box. There was broken glass in his pouch. His arm felt like it was on fire. That broken glass was the serum ampule. He had no serum. The remote shook. No, it was his hand shaking. He threw the switch and swung the crane. No, he had to turn off the armor curtain first. He was getting flashes of blackness. His heart was beating faster and faster. The armor curtain. He crawled to the bus bar and got it off. Back at the console, he looked up at the dome. He operated the remote, positioning the dome exactly above them so it would come down correctly. He threw the switch to lower it. It was coming down too slowly. The cables must be stiff. He could not help that. He got a hatchet out of his belt for the cables. He would have to be ready to hack them off the instant the humming stopped. Johnny lost track of time. He could still hear the humming of the wires. He looked toward Turl over on the platform. The monster seemed to have succeeded in opening the access plate. He was handling the bomb with great care, extracting the heavy metal core. Suddenly, Johnny knew what Turl was going to do. He would throw that core at him. It would travel like a bullet. It could go straight through him. Abruptly, Johnny saw something else. Brown Limper. He was rushing forward with a Thompson submachine gun in his hands. He had gone through where the armor curtain had been at the far end of the platform. He was trying to get so close to Johnny he couldn't miss. The dome was not yet down. Turl had the core in his paw now. He was going to throw it at Johnny. It was quieter. There was only smoke and falling snow and the creak of the cables lowering the dome. Johnny pointed at Brown Limper.
"Turl, he's going to shoot," he shouted.
Turl spun around and saw Brown Limper. He saw him raising the Thompson to aim it. One shot at this moment would shatter the firing. Turl threw. He threw with all his strength. The core hit Brown Limper in the side. It ripped through and hit his spine. The Thompson clattered to the ground. Brown Limper fell in a jerking tangle of arms and legs, screaming,
"Damn you, Tyler! Damn you!"
He lay still. The wires were still humming. Turl yelled at Johnny,
"I still win, rat brain."
He knew better than to move now. Johnny's head was pounding. His heart was going too fast. But he could shout back, and he felt he had to pin Turl there, distract him.
"Those coffins are full of sawdust. They were changed in your bedroom this morning," shouted Johnny.
Turl whirled to look at them.
"And the gold never went to Cyclo. We changed those, too," yelled Johnny.
Turl opened his mouth to shout. The platform cargo shimmered. The coffins full of sawdust shimmered. The Brigante corpses on the platform shimmered. Turl shimmered. And it was all gone. The platform was empty. Clean even of slush. The humming stopped. Johnny took his hatchet and slammed the blade down across the cables. It wasn't a full severance. He struck twice more. All the cables parted. Things were going blacker. No, it was the dome. The reworked plane skids on the bottom of it hit the metal. Johnny reached out to the dome interior and pulled closed the locking lever which annealed them to the metal the console sat on. It was very dark. He felt his time sense must have gone out, and then a fleeting thought that maybe Turl had extended the time for his own firing. Johnny had had a small mine lamp in his pouch. He made an effort to reach it. His whole body was beginning to shake as if everything was drawn too taut. A voice was talking to him. It was Sir Robert.
"Hurry, cut my hands loose."
Johnny had the hatchet. He made himself feel about for Sir Robert's hands. The blade was dull. The cord was resistant. Then he remembered with a surge of panic, there must be a time bomb under that console. It would blow Sir Robert to bits. He dropped the hatchet and put his hand to the console's side. It was terribly heavy. He only had one working arm, but he put his agonizing shoulder against the metal. He got the bottom of the console lifted. He fished along the lower edges, then a little higher. He felt it. It was taped on. Working with one hand, he got it loose and pulled it out. He let the console tip back in place. In the dark, he extracted the fuse from it. Johnny felt he was going unconscious. His heart was revving up, faster and faster. He had one more thing to do. The switch. The position of the switch. Johnny felt like he was being torn to pieces by his nerves pulling tight.
"Sir Robert, tell them the switch... the switch has to be in a down position. A down position for the next..."
The outside of the dome was struck a blow so hard the whole platform rocked. It was as though a dozen earthquakes had hit at once. As though the planet had been torn apart. Johnny stiffened out into blackness. He no longer heard the chaos going on outside. 5. About an hour before the firing, the orbiting group of ships had just come over the horizon that put them into position to view the American compound. A small Hauven spy craft in the orbit ahead of them had already reported some activity there earlier in the day. The report had only said that in the middle of the night, a group had been seen on infrascreens entering the compound area, and that the group had vanished, leaving only the usual sprawled about and apparently asleep night guards. The scanners of the orbiting combined force were now picking up something unusual down there on the approaching horizon. There seemed to be a more than normal number of people at the site. There was a local snowstorm in progress down there, and infra beams were a bit blurred. The attention of the combined force was not yet fixed on the compound, as it shortly would be. The command network of view screens was occupied by an interview that was going on. When Half-Captain Rogo-Dieter Snaul had gone back to Tallnep for reinforcements, he had contacted his uncle, Quarter-Admiral Snaul-Eater. Rogo-Dieter believed in keeping profit in the family. The quarter-admiral had come along gladly with a flotilla of 5 ships, the largest of which was the Terrify-class battle-plane-launching capital ship Capture. Snaul-Eater had not become a quarter-admiral without some skill, and he had brought part of that skill with him, a reporter. Ruf Arsebager considered himself the ace reporter of the Tallnep Midnight Fang. Even among news media of other systems, the Fang was envied as the very epitome of inaccuracy, corruption, and biased news. It always printed exactly what the government wanted, even while pretending to be anti-government. And Ruf Arsebager enjoyed the reputation of being the most poisonous reporter on a staff that specialized in them. The interview was being conducted by Arsebager on the Capture, and was addressed to Half-Captain Rogo-Dieter Snaul. It was just a background interview, and things were dull, so others were listening in. They had various opinions. The quarter-admiral was not well-liked.
Other commanders contested Snowleader's contention that he was the senior commander and therefore the head of the combined force, and that he was the uncle of the even less popular Rogoditer Snowl made him even less acceptable. They detested Snowl.
Now, getting back to the man on this counterfeit one-credit banknote, Arsabagger was saying, would you say that he was dishonest?
Oh, worse, replied Snowl.
Would the description, he is a known pervert, fit him?
Oh, worse, replied Snowl.
Good, good, said Arsabagger. We must keep this to a totally factual interview, you understand. How would he steals babies and drinks their blood do?
Fine, fine, said Snowl. Exactly.
I think you mentioned, said Arsabagger, when you filed dispatches, that you had several times met this, what is his name, this defiler of established governments, Tyler? Yes, that you met him in personal combat.
Other commanders were hearing this, and Rogoditer had not thought it would become public property. He had reckoned without the publicity hunger of his uncle.
Not exactly, said Rogoditer quickly. I meant to say that I tried, but he always ran away.
Quarter Admiral Snowleader's voice came from the background behind Arsabagger.
But he won't get away again. Now, in your opinion, Rogoditer, do you truly think this is the one?
The small gray man had been watching all this on his view screens. He detested reporters, and this Roof Arsabagger had earned his particular dislike. The reporter's fangs were stained nearly black, there were blotches of some disease on his face, and one could almost smell his unwashed condition over the view screen. Unfortunately or fortunately, whichever way you looked at it, his couriership had come in just yesterday. It had brought lots of odds and ends, but among them was the clear-cut statement that the one had not been found. Along with that, there was a prize edition. The 100 million credits originally offered by the Hauven Interrelated Confederation of Systems had been doubled by the Bulbod Equality Empire. The small gray man did not know what was going on in other sectors, much less other universes, but he could suppose that the same mad scramble was in progress. The courier dispatch box contents, when viewed as a whole, said that these were indeed very strange and troublesome times, that a problem like this had not existed in any past history they were aware of. And there had been some hints about the vital necessity of his presence, where he could do some good, instead of out here sailing around a 12th-rate Rimstar's only planet. There was no direct criticism, of course. There were just hints, an undertone. But actually, it would not matter whether he were home or not. Unless some solution presented itself, the chaos that was going to ensue would be so vast that neither he nor others could hope to control it. He was going on listening absently to this asinine reporter interview an asinine military mind when his bridge buzzer sounded and his watch officer's face appeared on the screen.
Your Excellency, said the watch officer, there is something going on down in that capital city area. The infra beams are scrambling. We cannot tell what is happening. There are no clear pictures.
The interview cut off suddenly. Other commanders seemed to have noticed it. The Hockner commander appeared on the small gray man's screen.
Your Excellency, I believe you said that was the central seat of government. We are getting pictures of massed troops and recordings of excessive heat. In your opinion, is this political?
The small gray man looked at his own screens of the area. Bad as they had been before due to a local storm, they were incredibly bad now. One couldn't make out a thing. Some sort of interference was blasting them off the air.
Wait. That jagged traveling line on the screen. A teleportation trace.
Hastily, the small gray man thought of an answer.
I believe, he said conservatively to the Hockner, that it is probably political in some connected way. All the information that...
His screens almost caved in. There was a tremendous flare, then nothing.
a squawk horn was going. Screen overload, screen overload.
Good heavens, you never got that except in a major battle area.
The small gray man rushed to his port as he knew the commanders must be doing. He stared down. There was a babble of incredulity on the remaining voice channels from the other ships.
Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 7, Side 2. He stared down. There was a babble of incredulity on the remaining voice channels from the other ships. The storm there had almost been exploded away. A fireball was climbing heavenward. Spreading, rolling masses of coiling smoke and flame were rising to incredible heights. Daylight was dimmed by the flash. It looked like the world had been torn apart. 6. Sir Robert hardly waited for the earth to cease rumbling. He did not even ask himself what it could be. He had only one idea in mind: to get his hands loose and help Johnny. He had seen the arrow strike Johnny. He had seen the lad pull it out. Sir Robert knew it was a poisoned arrow, and he had some idea of the consequences. After such venom entered, physical exertion would spread it all through the body much more quickly, and Johnny had been moving violently. When the hatchet had cut the cord, it had not gone all the way through. Sir Robert strained every sinew to part the remaining strands. It was dark as pitch in this dome. He could not even see where Johnny had fallen or which way he lay. But these confines were very close. He could and must get to him, even though it was probably already too late. He almost tore the skin off his wrists. The cord parted. In feverish haste, he reached out, felt around, and found Johnny's arm, the wounded arm. Sir Robert closed his huge hand around it, just below the armpit, and held it tight, shutting off the blood flow. The hatchet had fallen here somewhere. The rocking must have sent it skidding. Moaning with urgency, Sir Robert felt around the metal floor, under the console, under Johnny. Suddenly, his fingers contacted its handle in a corner. He got hold of the head, just back of the blade. He tried to cut through Johnny's radiation suit sleeve. It was so hard to work with just one hand, and in the dark. He was also trying desperately not to cut into Johnny's flesh. He got a fold of the suit and sawed through it. The hatchet had been dulled and chipped while cutting the cables. The leaded sleeve material was very resistant. He was not making it, not with one hand. Suddenly, he remembered that Johnny always had thongs in his pouch. It lay under his body, but he got it loose. He reached in and found broken glass that sliced his fingers. He paid it no attention. He found the end of a long thong and drew it out. He put a piece of twisted mine lamp metal under the arm and against the artery, and wrapped it around and in place with the thong. He drew the thong as tightly as he could and tied it. Now he could work. He cut the radiation suit sleeve away just below the tourniquet. He stripped it off the arm. The cloth was matted with blood. The arm was slippery with it. It was hard to find the wound because of the blood. He found it. He took the edge of the hatchet blade and cut an X across the wound hole. He got out of his air mask and put his mouth to the wound. Anything to get all the poison out that he could. Time and time again he sucked the wound dry and spat. The taste of the blood was stinging and bitter. There was venom in it, all right. Finally, he thought the blood was cleaner. He did not know how deep the arrow had gone, but there was no way to probe. He worked the flesh of the arm in a way he thought would force more poison up to the surface of the wound. He again applied his mouth to it. Yes, there was more bitterness. Then it seemed cleaner. Sir Robert felt around Johnny's belt for a wound compress pack. He didn't find one. Well, the bleeding was slightly less now. Maybe no vein had been hit. It was probably better without a compress. He felt the pulse of Johnny's other wrist. Devils in hell, it was racing. The pulse was way above anything he could count. Johnny's body was stretched taut. There was a tremble in the limbs. Sir Robert, in the dark, tried to find the ampule in Johnny's pouch. Planning dictated there should be one. That broken glass might have come from the mine lamp. He found the bottom half of the ampule. Although he couldn't see what he was doing, and it was just a gesture more than anything else, he opened the wound and upended the broken bottle over it, close to it, pouring in anything that might be in it. He held and massaged the flesh in such a way as to let any liquid drop lower in the wound. It was probably just his imagination, he thought, but the arm area felt slippery. He felt the pulse. It was racing faster, if anything, and the limbs were trembling more. Had he done all he could? He couldn't think of anything more. The air was getting used up in this close space, and he put his air mask back on. Johnny's radiation mask was in the way, and he took it off and checked the air mask under it. The flutter valve was moving slightly, but very rapidly. In briefing, they were supposed to put in a new bottle just before the first alert. If Johnny had done that, he had 2 hours of air. Sir Robert sank back. He worked the bonds off his ankles and then straightened Johnny's body out and raised Johnny's head to his own knee to keep the head higher. Double devils in hell, but the limbs trembled. He thought the situation over. He had not been in on the last briefings. He did not know whether there had been anything he should know now. Bitterly, Sir Robert cursed his own stupidity. Since things had been going so smoothly with the Academy move, one night he had walked by himself, like a daft sheep, to a knoll to look at the compound. Not really any purpose in it. Just a review of the field where a battle would soon be fought. And Brigantes had grabbed him. They must have been watching him for days. They had trussed him up and kept him in a cavern. They had tried to interrogate him and had beaten him. His nose was broken and full of dried blood even now. But he was too old a campaigner to talk. He did not know what they wanted with him until they brought him into the compound area and dumped him. He had not really thought they would take him to Cyclo until they put the air mask on him. The thought had made even him sweat. He had an excellent example of how the Cyclos interrogated Allison. Sir Robert had been braced to stand up to it. He had known of this attack, but he could not see how he could be fished out. A flamethrower was supposed to sweep that platform clean. And then this lad had thrown his flamethrower down and attacked. It looked like such a hopeless effort. Because of Sir Robert, this lad had thrown away his own chances. His own life? Sir Robert felt the pulse again. Good God, how long could a pulse race like that without a person dying? He began to get uneasy about the silence outside. There was supposed to be a standby rescue crew deep in the old compound, waiting with flatbeds and planes with both Dr. Allen and Dr. McKendrick, all in radiation suits and air masks. It was so silent in here. Was that a slight crackling sound? Johnny would have had a mine radio. Sir Robert felt around Johnny's belt and then scrabbled around the floor. He had it. A crackling sound was coming out of it. It was live, but no voices. Were they all dead out there? He pressed the transmit button. Hello? Hello? Not clever to say more. Who knew who might be out there? Silence. Hello? Hello? Then he thought he'd better give them a location. Not clever, but he had to do it. Console talking. Was that the click of a transmit switch? Then a voice in a whisper as though from far away. Is that you, Sir Robert? It was Thor's voice. Sir Robert almost wept with relief. Thor? Yes, Sir Robert. Thor, Johnny is in here. He has had a poisoned arrow in him. You've got to get him out quick. Then Dr. Allen. Sir, do you have a radiation suit on? No, blast ye. I've no suit. To heel with that. Get the lad out.
Sir, Is his suit whole?
Sir Robert realized he had torn the sleeve off.
No.
I'm sorry, sir,
whispered Dr. Allen over the mine radio.
To open that dome would kill you both. Have a little patience. We're trying to find out what we can do.
Patience be domned,
stormed Sir Robert. His extreme urgency was throwing his speech into dialect.
Get the lead out.
There was no answer. Sir Robert was about to start banging on the inside of the dome. Didn't they realize Johnny was probably dying in here? Then a tiny, piping, whispering voice took over.
Sir Robert?
It was one of the young Buddhist communicators, probably the youngest they had. They had turned him over to a child. The war chief was about to thunder a damnation at them when the child whispered, speaking Cyclo,
Sir Robert, they are doing all they can, honored sir. It is pretty bad out here.
Where are you? Demanded Sir Robert, reverting to Cyclo.
I am just outside the dome, honored sir. My mind radio is inside my air mask, under my radiation face shield. Excuse me that I whisper. We want nothing picked up by the visitors above. They can't hear this, and the mind radio won't reach them.
What are the visitors doing?
I don't know, Sir Robert. The snow clouds have closed in again. I see a pilot communicator. I will ask. I will be right back.
There was a long pause. Then the tiny, shrill little voice.
Sir, the pilot communicator says they have moved in orbit and are somewhere above us. They have this place being looked at. But our battle planes are standing by. Dunnel Dean is up there. He wants to know how we are. How is Lord Johnny?
Sir Robert felt the shaking limbs of the body resting against him, but he knew morale was a factor up there in the sky. He could not tell them he thought Johnny was dying, but Johnny was still alive.
Tell them they should not worry just now.
The child was gone for a bit. Then the tiny whispering voice.
The pilot communicator passed it on.
What are they doing here to get us out? Demanded Sir Robert.
What hell it was, sitting here in the dark waiting. Johnny's breathing was too rapid by far.
It's very bad out here, Sir Robert, very bad. If you hear crackling, it's the power lines. They are all shorted out and burning on the ground, throwing sparks.
Are there any casualties in the raiding party?
Oh, we don't know that, Sir Robert. The rescue team is using blade scrapers to uncover the coffins. I'm standing beside a hole where the platform used to be. It's smoking. Is it hot in there?
Sir Robert had not noticed. Then he realized that the dome was warm to the touch. He said so.
I'm told to tell you not to release the annealing lever on the dome skids. It is a wonder that they held. So don't release the lever. They will move the whole metal platform.
Somebody else was coming through on the channel.
Dwight, can you hear us? Dwight!
The tiny voice of the child said,
They found his coffin under the ravine bank just now. The bank caved in on it. They have found a forklift in the garage that operates, and they are lifting the coffin. They are opening the lid. Dwight looks stunned, but he is sitting up.
They should be working on this dome, raged Sir Robert.
Oh, there's a whole other team working on it, honored sir. They are bringing a small crane out of the lower levels of the compound now. I see a man throwing clamps on the big crane. It is on its side, and they have to lift it upright.
Sir Robert was getting an idea of what it was like out there.
We were down in the 16th level,
said the tiny voice.
The concussion was bad. It grabbed air out of the place, but nothing was heard.
Well, what was it? What happened? Demanded Sir Robert.
We don't know, honored sir.
They had some nuclear weapons on standby. Did they explode?
There was a pause. The child had gone off somewhere. He came back.
No, sir. Thor says they are intact and he is awfully relieved. They didn't explode.
Then what was it?
I am so very sorry, sir. None of us knows. Oh, here comes a blade scraper to loosen your platform so it can be lifted. The first one they had broke down after they got the fire out of it. I am told you must be patient, sir. We are doing all we can.
Then,
they've got three more coffins out now.
A pause. Then sorrow.
The one they call Andrew is dead.
The platform gave a jolt as the blade scraper seemed to pry under it. Sir Robert could hear a motor roar. There was a shout of alarm and then a crash. Then the piping little voice,
"One of the poles fell in the crater. No one was hurt. Here comes your flatbed truck, sir."
"Flatbed?" barked Sir Robert. "It's supposed to be a plane. We're supposed to airlift out of here."
There was a pause. The Buddhist communicator had gone off somewhere. He came back.
"They have found a river to the south. It is the Purgatoire. The pilots told us."
Sir Robert felt Johnny's pulse, racing.
"I don't understand," cried Sir Robert. "Time is everything here. I need serum. Can't we lift this dome and push some serum in here?"
"I am sorry, Sir Robert. The Purgatoire is 120 miles south of here. It's on an ancient man-highway."
He rushed on so Sir Robert wouldn't interrupt.
"They have mine pumps out. All our equipment and planes are contaminated. They have to be hosed down to get rid of radiation. When that's done, they can open the dome."
Sir Robert clenched his fists. 120 miles. How long would that take? The child must have been reading his thoughts.
"I am told they will drive very fast. They can on the ancient highway. Thor himself will drive your flatbed. They know how important it is. Your flatbed will be the first to leave. They have your crane standing up now."
There was another chunk from the blade scraper. Something under the platform seemed to tear loose.
"They have found 15 coffins now," said the child. "The Scots in them were all alive except one. The coffin was blown into the air and smashed his skull. The lead on the outside of the coffins is all melted. The tops, I mean. They're hot to the touch, and it's hard to handle them."
There was a groan and a squeak as the crane hook on top of the dome tightened. They were being very careful from the sound of it not to drop the lower platform off. The annealing skids held. Sir Robert felt them swinging in the air, then a thump as they hit the top of the flatbed body. They picked it up again to let it drop down more squarely. The child must still be standing on the platform overhanging. The tiny voice calmly came through.
"I can see better from here. It's not snowing. Way out on the plain over there, I see some bodies. Must be the Brigante tribe. And I can see more coffins."
He yelled to someone and must be pointing.
"The whole top of the old compound had blown off. It's wide open to the winds."
Sir Robert was feeling Johnny's pulse. Was it weaker?
"Thor is turning over to someone. He is climbing in your truck now. He says he's a good driver. Don't worry. He will go as fast as he can. Excuse me, but I am supposed to get in the cab and tie a seatbelt."
The flatbed started up with a roar. It jolted and banged over the uneven terrain. Sir Robert steadied Johnny's head. Was he still breathing? They hit the ancient man highway. The engine revved into a high-pitched scream. Sir Robert remembered Johnny had had a watch. He tried to find its illumination button. The numbers were rolling. They were driving so fast, Sir Robert could hear the wind roaring outside the dome.
Time, time, time.
50 minutes. 52 minutes. 59 minutes. The flatbed abruptly slowed. It jolted down some rough ground. It halted with a surge. It dropped to the earth. The small piping voice again.
"We are at the river bank. There is plenty of water. They are rigging a mine pipe. I must get away from the dome while it is washed down. I have to get washed down myself, and so do the others. Then they will test with breathe gas."
Water was suddenly pounding against the dome. It roared and reverberated inside. The sound went all around. and then the water went all over the flatbed, apparently. There was silence then. Then the piping voice.
Sir Robert, the truck with the small crane has arrived and has been washed down. So have I. Can you find the release lever in there? The one outside is bent.
Sir Robert had already located, and indeed had been on the verge of pulling it an hour ago. He yanked it open. There was a roar and a clank as a crane was moved closer and connected. The dome lifted. Murky daylight hit his eyes. Johnny was lying there. Was he breathing? The owner of the small voice was standing there, dripping water, visor and air mask off. He was about 13.
My name is Kwong. Thank you for being so patient with me, Sir Robert. I was as worried as you.
Dr. Allen jumped up on the flatbed. He had a syringe in his hand and was grabbing Johnny's arm. A woman nurse took over. She was holding Johnny's head. Sir Robert stood up unsteadily. He was drenched with sweat, and the wind was cold. He looked to the north. The sky was glowing there.
What's that? He demanded.
Thor was there, another member of the rescue team. More trucks were arriving further downstream. Thor said,
That's Denver.
Sir Robert stared. They had just come from hell. Chapter 25 1 For the first time in what had been a dreary, wearisome year, the small gray man was intense and interested. Hope, to which he had become a stranger, struggled to rise in his breast. Faint still, but it was there. He had no real interest in the overpowering flash they had seen, and almost did not bother to watch the roiling, filthy mass of violent cloud which rose above the earth. It was that momentary trace on his screen, a teleportation firing, a trace he had never hoped to see again. His immediate reaction was to see whether any of these military minds in the ships around had seen the flickering trace. He listened anxiously to their chatter.
It was obviously a nuclear explosion, said the Bulbod.
That settled it for him. He thrust his pugnacious face forward from his collar until it was almost visible, as though daring somebody to dispute him. The Tallnep half-captain made an immediate proposal to go down there and
really wipe the place out.
The Hauven speculated that the situation might be political and sought to pull the small gray man into it. But the small gray man was noncommittal. He was waiting to see what the others knew. It was the Hockner super-lieutenant who summed it up. He put his monocle to his eye and sniffed at them.
You fellows are missing the point, rather, he said. Earlier intelligence told of a night raiding party vanishing in the area. Quite obviously, what we have just seen is the culmination of a political surface war. And I rather say that the government has now changed hands. As we know, the political scene was unstable. A priesthood earlier took over the planet, those yellow fellows in the robes. But they lost out, perhaps, and were driven back to that temple in their southern hemisphere. Some military group, he concluded, has now obliterated the former capital of the planet with nuclear weapons. With two separate revolts in just the last few months, the political climate is highly unstable, and the time is ripe for a concerted attack by us.
Yes, rumbled the Bulbod. We should go right down and smear them.
The Jambit Chow commander laughed lightly.
I am afraid you will have to count me out, gentle sirs. For the moment, at least. Have you looked over there at that shoulder on the mountain peak? The one just to the west of the capital?
There was silence, and then some startled gasps. 15 assorted battle planes and marine attack carriers were just now rising into view.
It was an ambush, said the half-captain.
Bah, said the Bulbod. Their firepower does not compare to even one of our major vessels.
They could be quite nasty, said the Jambit Chow in his lilting voice.
There was a lull.
Abruptly, a face filled the viewer of the small gray man. It was Rufe Arsabager of the Midnight Fang, calling from the Tallnep Terrify class battle plane launching capital ship capture.
Your Excellency, drooled the reporter, could we take advantage of this lull to get your personal reactions to this general situation?
The small gray man was always calm, never emotional. All he said, and in a quiet voice, was,
get out of my view screen. Oh, yes, sir, Your Excellency. Indeed, sir, Your Excellency. At once, sir.
The diseased face vanished. The small gray man made a grimace of distaste and then went back to considering the rest of them. Sooner or later, they would come to some conclusion and take some concerted action. So far, none had mentioned the teleportation trace. None of them was coming to any logical conclusion. Was each one privately hungering for prize money and keeping the rest in the dark? He would listen. It was always safe to listen. The combined force had come alive and was changing position in orbit so as to maintain its location above this area. Flashes of engine exhausts were apparent in the sky around, and a mutter of internal ship commands trickled through the channels. They were readying themselves. It was the Hoven who finally expressed something that might have been on all their minds, the rewards.
I have just worked out that they might be the one and don't know. There is a report here of a big cyclo walking around a firing platform down there earlier this day.
Well, if it was a cyclo, don't you think he would have known? Said the Jambit Chow commander.
This brought the Hockner super-lieutenant into it.
If the silly fool didn't know, he still might have been the one.
But if he had been the one, said the Hoven, he would know. And he didn't know, so this isn't the one.
The quarter-admiral chipped in, tapping a tooth thoughtfully.
As the possibility now exists that they are the one.
Other faces looked at him on their view screens, unable to figure out how he had gotten to this conclusion.
Why, then I see no reason to hold off further from simply raiding the place and gutting it and then clearing out. But, on the other hand, continued the quarter-admiral in a brilliant spurt of logic, if they are the one, then they constitute an extreme danger to us and should be raided. Either way, we simply raid it, divide up the loot, and clear out.
And the reward money? Said the Jambit Chow.
Why, said the quarter-admiral, we can best find out about that with an extensive interrogation of the resulting prisoners. As commander-in-chief of this combined force.
There were instant protests. They agreed that in any event they should attack, gut the place, and clear out. But they didn't agree that the quarter-admiral was their commander-in-chief. This produced a very sour effect on quarter-admiral Snowleader. Rufe Arsabager being aboard, he wanted to get the best possible image. This disagreement didn't fit with it, and it made him quite cross. The ensuing wrangling took considerable time, and the small gray man returned to studying the scene below. He had spotted a small convoy racing south. It was in two sections. The first, smaller section, was streaking down what must have been an ancient highway. The second was larger and driving nearly as fast. At first, it might appear that the second was chasing the first. But now they had come together without a fight on the banks of a river. They must all be the same group. The stream was in spring flood, and shortly after the arrival of the first section, water pumps were placed and huge sprays of water were visible. They were spraying down their vehicles and themselves. The action was not known to the small gray man, so he consulted some reference books.
Radiation.
The way to get rid of contamination was copious use of water. The particles could be washed down and away due to their weight.
Then that had been a nuclear blast.
The cyclos, down through the ages, had remorselessly suppressed anyone seeking to use such weapons. It was a nearly forgotten chapter of ancient warfare.
The small gray man had his communication officer tune in his view screens better. There was haze and overcast down there, a little difficult to see through. The city to the north had begun to burn quite fiercely, a glow under the clouds of spiring smoke. The wind was from the south, and even though this left the river area where the trucks had arrived clearer, there was a lot of interference. Ah, it was that shorting power line to the old mine site. It made the view screen jump and distort. It took some time for the group at the river to sort itself out. What were they? Refugees? The remains of an attack force? And then he saw it. Under that dome they had raised, with a crane, a teleportation console. He began to piece this situation together. He did not know why or how, but that fight and explosion had to do with teleportation. One or another of these commanders in the ships about him would invite his advice. He would answer noncommittally. For once, he would not be helpful at all. He hoped and prayed they would not see that console down there. The group apparently had some wounded and were caring for them, and their attention for quite a span was not on security. The console was sitting there plain as day. Finally, 6 Marine attack battle planes flew in and landed. There was heavy air cover over this group quite in addition to the landed planes. The small gray man kept his eye on that console. They finally shrouded it and moved it into one of the Marine attack planes. The Hockner super-lieutenant suddenly said, "Wasn't that a transshipment console they transferred from truck to plane? I'm playing back my screens." The small gray man sagged. He had not wanted them to see that. He had hoped they wouldn't recognize one if they did see it. Vain hope.
"It is," said the Hockner.
It took them quite a while to load down there. Some of the Marine attack planes were quite empty. 2 were very fully loaded. The small gray man looked up capacities. Yes, 2 Marine attack planes could handle that entire party. The commanders were now chattering at a great rate. Some had seen pictures of such consoles. There was a rising tide of excitement, a rising vision of sharing in 200 million credits of reward money. Then the group down there abandoned the flatbeds and pumps and a crane and what might be a couple of coffins. 6 Marine attack planes took off. And then they did a very puzzling and confusing thing. Instead of assuming an orderly formation, they began to crisscross each other's bows and circle and dart. It was quite impossible, even on a screen playback, to tell which Marine attack carrier was which. 4 of them landed again. Which 4? Which were the loaded ones? The commanders really chattered over this. They were playing back screens, looking for identifying marks. Not possible in this static. Abruptly, the Hockner solved it. 2 of the planes, with only a small part of the additional air cover, took off at a leisurely pace, only 1,000 miles an hour, on a northeasterly course. The other 4 and the remaining, but majority air cover planes, stayed at the river.
"It's a lure," cried the super-lieutenant. "They want us to follow that northeast group."
They watched, plotting the course of the northeast group. It would pass over this side of the pole and, unless it stopped before that, would wind up at that pagoda place in the southern hemisphere, and at that speed would get there in about 9 hours. As if to confirm the Hockner's suspicions, the remaining 4 Marine attack planes and the rest of the air cover suddenly streaked away on a course slightly to the west of north. They were traveling at 2,000 miles an hour. A hasty extrapolation of their course gave their only possible destination as an ancient mine site near a place which had been called Singapore.
"That does it, old fellow," said the Hockner. "There is a report here that there's been heavy activity in that area and some sort of platform being laid out. They're taking that console to Singapore."
The quarter admiral tried to disagree. As the senior officer, he had a right to be obeyed. He explained that it must be the pagoda. The reason was that he hated all religions. religious people were zealots and upset governments and always had to be crushed. This obviously was a religious revolt, and they even had evidence of it. A religious order had upset the government of the planet and had now stolen a console. This planet was the one, and he ordered them all to head for the pagoda objective. His order did it. The combined force streaked into controlled motion, in full cry, after the Singapore-bound group. But the mighty Terrify-class battle plane launching capital ship Capture did not follow them. Egged on by Ruf Arsabager into independent action that would make better copy, and by a scathing hatred of all religions, Quarter Admiral Snowleader turned his ponderous and overwhelming ship, with its belly full of battle planes, toward Kariba. 2. Johnny woke with a start of alarm. The ground had shaken. A woman nurse, who must have been at his bedside, left the room. He stared around him, for a moment unable to place the unfamiliar surroundings. Then he recognized them. It was the bunker room at Kariba that the Chinese had fixed up especially for him, at the inner edge of the hollow of the firing platform. They had ringed the inside hill with deep bunkers and even tiled some of them. They were lit with mine lights. This one was tiled in yellow. It was furnished with a bed, chairs, and a wardrobe. They had even done a portrait of Chrissy in the tiles, taking it from a picto recorder shot. It looked quite like her, except that they had slightly slanted her eyes. The ground jolted again. Bombs? He was just about to swing out of bed when Dr. Allen came in and soothingly pushed him back.
"It's all right," said Dr. Allen. "They have things under control out there."
He was taking Johnny's pulse. Sir Robert showed up in the doorway. He had a bandage across his nose, which Dr. Allen had set. He was obviously waiting for Dr. Allen to finish.
"You had a nasty one," said Dr. Allen, "but your pulse is normal now. That prevention shot of serum you had handled some of the venom reaction. But you really owe it all to Sir Robert. He got the poison out, and even gave you a few drops of serum."
Johnny's huge cyclo wristwatch was lying on the side table. He stared at it. He had been asleep for 18 hours. Lord knows what had happened in that time. Dr. Allen anticipated him.
I know, but it was necessary to put you on an opiate to slow your heart down.
He had a stethoscope on Johnny's chest. He listened. Then he folded it up.
"I can't detect any heart damage. Hold out your hand."
Johnny did.
"Ah, no tremble," said Dr. Allen. "I think you're fine. A few days in bed."
At that moment, the ground jolted again. Johnny tried to get up, and Dr. Allen pushed him back again.
"Sir Robert," called Johnny, "what's happening?"
Dr. Allen nodded to Sir Robert that it was all right, and then left. Sir Robert came over to stand beside the bed. He was not answering Johnny's questions. He just stood there beaming down at Johnny, glad to see him alive. The lad even had color in his cheeks.
"What is happening?" said Johnny, spacing each word.
"Oh," said Sir Robert, "that's a Tolnap ship up there. It's at about 200 miles, but it keeps sending down planes to bomb this place. We have air cover. Stormalong is here and directing air defenses. So far, the enemy is giving Singapore its main attention."
Angus was at the door. Johnny called to him,
"Have you set up the console?"
"Oh, aye," said Angus.
He came in.
"That's why they didn't disturb you."
He pointed a finger up.
"With all that firing, our anti-aircraft outside the screen, and the motors of our own planes, we wouldn't dare use the firing rig. It's all connected. The Chinese set that place up very nice."
"The next firing position of the switch is down," said Johnny.
"Yes, Sir Robert told us that. It's all ready to go if this firing ever stops. Get a rest."
Angus left and passed Thor. Thor said, "How do you feel?" Johnny waved his hand negatively.
Unimportant. The last I remember was being in the dome. You better bring me up to date. They told him what had happened and what they had done.
A recoil that bad?
Said Johnny.
Worse, said Thor.
How many men did we lose?
Said Johnny.
Andrew and MacDougall, said Thor. But we have 15 of them here in this little hospital they have. Couple of concussions, broken arms or legs. Mostly bruised, very badly bruised. The lead of the coffins protected them. No radiation burns. Andrew was badly bayoneted by the Brigantes and couldn't fasten his coffin lid from inside, and it blew open.
And MacDougall, said Johnny.
Well, that one is sort of bad. He had the station over by the old cage, and the coffin was jolted out of the ground. We couldn't find his body for a while, and that's what got us looking.
Johnny noticed Thor was holding a heavy package. He had steadied it against the table.
We had to start looking for corpses. They had been blown all around, most of the flesh burned off. We followed the blast line, thinking his body had been blown directly away from the platform, and we got into what was left of Turtle's office. The whole top of it had been blown off. Four or five bodies from the platform edge had been blown into that area. We didn't want to leave anyone listed simply as missing, so we were trying to identify bodies. We found MacDougall's body. And we found this. He was unwrapping the heavy package. I know you will be relieved to have it. One of the corpses had all the flesh burned off, and the vertebrae were exposed, and this was sticking in them. It was a pea-sized pellet of the unknown core material of the bomb.
Brown limper, said Johnny.
Turl threw it at him, like a bullet.
Yes, I am very, very glad you found it.
We got the other package Turtle handed to him, said Thor. We gave it to Angus, and he disarmed it.
What does it do?
We don't really know, said Johnny.
But knowing Turl, we got his whole recycling basket, said Thor. We figured he'd try to use it, and we cut the power off. It's really full.
It's out here on a dolly if you want it.
We had it in a radiation-proof mine sack, fortunately.
He beckoned toward the door.
We grabbed it right after he left his office.
A ghillie wheeled the dolly in. They had stacked the material neatly on it.
Don't try to fire those assassin pistols, said Thor. Kerr put a plug in them so they'd shoot out the back at the user. Kerr said to tell you, and that he'd fix them back.
They handed Johnny some of the booklets and papers that had been in the false backs and bottoms of the cabinets. Johnny had a lot of it already. His eye was caught by a pamphlet, Known Defenses of Hostile Races and Surveys of Their Homelands. He thumbed through it.
A lot of planets here.
He looked under Tallnep. This planet is a planet of a double star system. See coordinate chart for location. The system itself has only three inhabited planets, the 7th, 8th, and 9th. The Tallnep homeland is the 9th planet. It has 5 moons. Of these, only Asart is important. It is used as the launch of major war vessels. No Tallnep vessel can operate in atmosphere due to the great inefficiency of its star energy drives, which, being essentially reaction engines, use up too much of their power in atmospheres. After construction, such vessels are based on the moon, Asart, and their crews and material are ferried to them from planet surface. Since plans have been proposed from time to time to occupy and mine the Tallnep planet, and since usual offensive tactics are thought to be adequate in the event of such a war, the moon Asart has not been assaulted up to the time of this writing. Johnny looked at the cyclo date. It was only a couple of years old. The catalog went on. Johnny laid it down. Another thud and ground shake. Suddenly, Johnny was aware of the underlying tension in all those who had come in. They were just trying to make him feel easy. Thor had received an urgent summons while he had been reading. And now a communicator rushed in with a sheaf of dispatches for Sir Robert and rushed out.
Johnny saw the frown flicker across Sir Robert's face as he read them. "The situation is worse than you're letting on, isn't it?" said Johnny.
"No, no," said Sir Robert. "Dinna fret yoursel, laddie."
"What is the situation?" demanded Johnny. Sir Robert never dropped into dialect unless agitated. The grizzled old Scot sighed and recovered his university accent. This book is continued on Cassette 8, Side 1.